Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Jaw-dropping.
Jaw-dropping. So this jaw-dropping thing that nobody ever predicted, what's that all about?
It's a NASA scientist, Fred.
Oh, it's an evolutionist. So something else that's surprising, shocking. This one's jaw-dropping.
It's always shocking because it contradicts their fundamental predictions. It's not just that they were looking for something and they said, oh, look at that. Who would have ever guessed that? It's that these predictions contradict their primary claims about the evolution of life, of planets, of stars, and so on.
So we got to add this to our list of quotes from evolutionists. This is shocked. I'm surprised, amazed.
Horrendous.
Horrendous.
Right. It's horrifying.
This is jaw-dropping. Their jaws drop because their mouths are gaped open.
Well, what was this NASA scientist talking about?
Well, from Creation Magazine, the fall 2012 issue.
Yeah.
I actually had this magazine open at work today.
Oh.
Reading through it through lunch. And a coworker came in. He's talking work and stuff. And he goes, okay, I have to ask, what does Mercury have to do with evolution? Because he knows I'm a creationist.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, what does it have to do with that in millions of years? And I'm like, well, here, let me tell you.
Why don't
you sat down and we talked about it.
Oh, you did. Isn't that great? Well, let's do the same thing now, but with the audience.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So, Fred, the first thing that this Creation magazine points out about Mercury, and there are really great things in this article, but the first thing are these blue hollows. And this is interesting. There are these weird-shaped holes, depressions, that pockmark the surface of Mercury, and they have bluish halos, and their interiors are blue.
Yeah. Do they have any impact craters on them?
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that is.
They don't have small impact craters.
Now, what does that mean?
That means, according to the atheistic materialist crater theory, that they have to be young. Because they believe that if they were there for billions of years, then they'd be all pockmarked. And they're not.
They're not. So they have to be young. That makes sense. That's logical, right?
Yeah. And also, there's something even worse here. They say not only that, but these things are growing.
They're growing. Okay.
So
this isn't some inert dead planet, right?
Now, we'll get to that with the magnetism of Mercury, which is just a tremendous piece of evidence for young Earth creationists. But yeah, it's not a dead planet. And isn't that what the atheist model predicted, that the sun and the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago? And so by now, certainly all the smaller bodies like Mercury would be dead.
Yeah, they'd be dead. And that's what the textbooks teach, right?
Yeah, they'd be inert.
Just a dead planet.
Yeah, geologically inert. That's it. Well, lo and behold, its surface is changing. In fact, there are hundreds of transient events on the surface of the moon that NASA has now documented, and they don't like it, and they like to downplay it, because the moon is supposed to be dead, but we're on Mercury, right?
So they're analyzing these images from the Messenger spacecraft, and what are they showing? They're showing these hollows, as they call them.
Yeah.
They're actually growing.
Mm-hmm.
They're actively forming today.
Yeah, and that's what they are saying. The NASA team leaders and the NASA scientists are saying, hey, this is a jaw-dropping thing that nobody ever predicted. These things are actively forming today. That shows they're relatively young. That's cool. Not only that, there's something about Mercury that just shouldn't be. It's got a lot of sulfur on it.
A lot of sulfur. That's what they call a volatile material, right? So
yeah.
Mercury, which is close to the sun, shouldn't the sulfur not be there?
Right. They say that the theory of planet formation is that there's a reason why the rocky planets are close to the sun and the gas giants are far away from the sun, because of the different elements. And so sulfur would not survive that close to the sun as Mercury was gradually forming. First, it's a nebula, a gas cloud of gas and dust, and it's spinning, and gradually it's forming into planets. That whole story doesn't work for reasons that astronomers are well aware, and they don't have answers, but they pretend to the public that they have answers. But anyway, all the sulfur on Mercury should have burned away, and yet it's there, and there's way more of it there than on Earth.
Yeah, there's 15 times more sulfur on Mercury than there is on Earth, and we're farther away from the sun.
Right, we're a lot further away. So what's up, Kemosabe? What's going on? It turns out that on observation after observation, what we find contradicts what the evolutionists predicted. That's really fun.
I really love this next one. Before 1974, before the Mariner spacecraft went zooming past Mercury and taking these measurements, the textbooks taught that Mercury, again, was a dead, inert planet. Well, they discovered something about Mercury that pretty much shot holes right through that. And so back in 1974, you had a whole bunch of scientists whose jaws were dropping to the ground. And the creationists were just
shocking.
Nodding. We nod, like, yeah, we kind of, you know, we expected that.
Right.
Their jaws are dropping.
It's horrifying.
And how come?
Well, because they found that Mercury has a magnetic field.
A dead planet has a magnetic field.
And it wasn't supposed to. This is back in 1975. What were you doing in 1975? I was in high school. Well, the Mariner 10 spacecraft was flying by Mercury, and they said, you know what? This is shocking, but apparently it has a magnetic field, and they measured it. But then things got even more confounding for the evolutionist, because then Messenger, the spacecraft Messenger, flew by back in 2008, and the magnetic field, you remember what happened?
Yeah, it decreased.
It decreased significantly, and the evolutionists thought, this is impossible. How could it be? Because if the planet is billions of years old, first of all, it shouldn't have a magnetic field. If it does, certainly after all this time, it's reached some kind of a stasis, an equilibrium. It can't lose a few percent of its energy in just these few years. So then they went back again.
They went back again, yeah, 2 years later, right? Messenger went by Mercury 2011, and they measured it again. And lo and behold, the total decrease since 1975 was 8%. 8% decrease.
8%. Now, that is, for them, jaw-dropping.
Jaw-dropping. They did not expect a magnetic field. They did not expect it to decrease.
Right. So the evolutionary predictions were wrong, as we know is usually the case. But how about the creationist predictions? Well, Fred, you and I have often talked about Dr. Russell Humphreys.
Yeah, he's a scientist that worked at Sandia Labs for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And he made predictions of Uranus and Neptune's magnetic field strength before the Voyager went there.
Right.
So, and this is how science is supposed to work. You make your predictions, and then you check the results later. And his predictions on the magnetic field strength of those planets was pretty much dead on.
It was.
And light years away from the evolutionist predictions.
Astonishingly accurate.
He's nodding, and their jaws are dropping.
Right. And they thought they wouldn't even have magnetic fields. And then he also predicted in advance and published what the field strength of Mercury would be. And his predictions, he did it through 1990 when he published.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just extend his formula, it equates to about a 5% decrease by 2011, and it turned out to be about an 8%.
Maybe his jaw dropped just a little bit.
Yeah. The decay of the magnetic field of Mercury was even faster than Dr. Humphreys had predicted. Still, he got Uranus and Neptune spot on, and he was right. What a bold prediction for him to say that the magnetic field of Mercury is going to significantly decay. And that was before there was proof that the magnetic field was decaying, because we take these measurements and we see, look, it's decaying. So that's neat. As you said, Fred, this is how science should be done. You take your model, you make predictions, and then when the predictions are contrary to the general belief, that's really powerful.
Well, you know, and this guy at work said the Earth has a magnetic field. And I said, yeah, it does. Did you know it's decaying also? We've been measuring that since the 1800s, right?
Yeah.
We've had measurements of that since then, and it's decaying.
Significantly, so rapidly.
And I think when you push back, if you go back as far as you can to where life could exist on this planet, I think it puts a maximum age in the 40,000 year range.
Well, yeah, in just a few tens of thousands of years, the Earth would be so hot that the oceans would evaporate.
That's right.
So there is a maximum age of the Earth just based on the magnetic field. And Fred, we have been measuring the strength of the magnetic field since the 1800s, but more recently, in the last decades, an international body of geologists have been doing systematically. They publish the results every 5 years. They're on the internet. Anybody could go through the data, put it in your spreadsheet. There's a rapid decay of the magnetic field of the Earth. How rapid is it?
Exponential.
It's exponential. And so this is, again, powerful evidence. And it's shocking to the evolutionist because the Earth couldn't be doing this for millions or billions of years.
Yeah. Then there's the Mariner spacecraft that took measurements of the gravity of Mercury, and it suggested that it was a lot more dense than the evolutionists had ever predicted. In fact, it's very dense. It's a dense planet.
Way more dense, because what they say is that these planetesimals, really they just mean these meteors and asteroids, were gradually banging together and forming larger and larger rocks, and eventually they became planets. Now, astronomy textbooks will admit on an especially honest page that, quote, we don't know how this happens, unquote, because they don't know, because when you model it, the laws of gravity, gravitational attraction, is really well known. And so you could simulate it in a computer, and you could look at rocks in space and see what they actually do, and they don't come together and accumulate the way dust molecules mm-hmm. do. For one, as one body would approach, say, the sun or the Earth, like an asteroid or a comet, it speeds up as it approaches because the magnetic field increases mm-hmm. exponentially. And then usually they shoot by each other, or they crash into each other and bust each other up. So it is extremely difficult to show using math and physics how you create a planet, just like it's hard to show how you create a star. So if these rocks keep busting up, the most you're going to get is a loose pile of rocks. That's about it. Like, some asteroids are loose piles of rocks, yeah. by the way. But you're not going to get a planet as unbelievably dense as Mercury.
Yeah, evolutionists say that Mercury can't be that dense,
right.
yet it is.
Yeah.
My wife tells me I can't be that dense,
yeah,
but I think I am.
Yeah. yeah. And me too. Does your wife know my wife? But it is that dense. So what do the evolutionists say about Mercury being dense?
Well, we kind of joked before the show. It's Mike the Meteor. You know, they've got these magic wand things they come up with.
Al the asteroid.
Al the asteroid, yeah. That it banged into Mercury, and then it freed up all the loose elements. They went off into space somewhere.
All the lighter elements were gone, and you're left with this dense iron core. But what about the sulfur?
Yeah.
When the sulfur be gone? That gives the sulfur two times to burn away.
That's right.
Two chances.
That's right, and it's still there.
And there it is. So what's interesting, these DVDs by Spike Passaris that are my favorite astronomy DVDs, it's volume one and volume two. I highly recommend them. He points out in the first one on the solar system that they're always calling these asteroids to the rescue.
Yeah, they
are. Over
and
over. Every time they have a problem, which is with almost every planet,
yeah.
and they say, well, how could this be? This planet actually cannot exist. But there it is. And they say, must be an asteroid.
Yeah.
Dun, da, da, da. Here
comes
the asteroid.
Like the meteor to the rescue.
Yeah.
Like Venus. They don't expect it to rotate the way it does. So, hey, let's get Mike the Meteor out of our playbook, and that's the answer.
Right. And so they hate appealing to catastrophes on Earth, but in space, where things are so far apart.
Yeah, they do
everything
all the time.
Is a catastrophe. Everything is a catastrophe, and it solves.
Isn't Uranus tilted over? They don't understand that.
What a great point. Right. It's not spinning on its axis vertically the way the planets are orbiting the sun. It's rolling. Like horizontally,
that's right.
Rolling around the sun.
They say long ago, guess what hit it?
Dun, da, da, da.
Yeah, Mike the Meteor.
Al the asteroid. It really is over and over and over. So Mercury should not be that dense. They say Al the asteroid came, hit it, and all the light stuff, except for the sulfur, blew out into space, and all the heavy stuff remained, and that's how we got dense Mercury.
Yep. I like some of these Mercury morsels here. On Mercury, you can jump 2.5 times as high as you can on Earth. So I was wondering, if I played basketball on Mercury, would I be able to jump? Then it occurred to me 0 times 2.5 is still zero. So I probably would.
So Fred, from the Carnegie Institute for Science, they say this: most previous ideas about Mercury's chemistry are inconsistent with what we have actually measured on the planet's surface. Reminds me of Lawrence Krauss.
Who's that guy? Isn't he a big believer in the Big Bang?
He is. He's a theoretical physicist, emphasis on the theoretical. And Fred, remember he said all evidence overwhelmingly supports the Big Bang. And we're thinking, now, wait a minute. On almost every observation you could make, you find leading scientists, astronomers, astrophysicists saying, you know what? This is the opposite of what we predicted. This is a problem. We don't know how to solve this problem. So Mercury, evolutionists say it can't be dense, but it is. Evolutionists say it cannot have a magnetic field, but it does. They say it can't have sulfur, but it does.
We can go planet by planet. We can go exoplanet, right?
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, because what? They said that the reason the gas giants formed far out in the solar system, far out, man, is because if they formed close to the sun, they couldn't form because the sun would consume all their gas, all their matter that made them up. So the rocky, hard planets formed in the inner solar system, and the gas giants formed far away. But you just mentioned the exoplanets.
That's right. And what about hot Jupiters?
Oh, yeah, because these massive gas giants orbiting other stars other than our sun are so close, they're in what would be called the inner solar system. So they say, oops, we have to go back to the drawing board. So, Fred, they devised this theory of how a solar system would form to explain our solar system, except that it doesn't do it. Planet after planet, they say, you know what? It shouldn't be there, but there it is. And now they take this model and they look at exoplanets and they really blast the model to pieces. And also, where do they say the comets formed? Because comets only last for thousands of years, tens of millions.
Yeah, they can't explain why comets still exist because every time they go around the sun, they lose some of their mass, right? So they should only be around some several thousands of years, not billions of years.
Right.
So they invented this thing called the Oort cloud.
The Oort cloud
pumps out these comets here and there.
And the Kuiper belt.
Yep.
And so they're way out there. And so what do we find
the
when we finally...
Those objects are way out there.
Both. And so we have now gone to comets. We've returned to Earth matter from comets, which is so awesome. And Walt Brown's prediction, his theory of what comets are, has been just so wonderfully vindicated because they have minerals like you find on Earth. In fact, comets are like dirty snowballs. And one element common on comets is olivine. And olivine is the most common mineral on Earth.
Okay, so wait a minute. You're saying that comets share something with Earth.
Right. So how could they have formed way out in the outer reaches of the solar system where these heavy minerals are not supposed to form? And way in on the innermost part of the solar system, you have all this sulfur. And how about all the water on Earth? Water is made of hydrogen and oxygen. The Earth, here we are in the inner solar system, and the Earth has got all this water on it.
Yeah, I think there's so much water that if you flattened out the mountains, wouldn't the water cover the surface by like a mile and a half?
Whoa, there is so much water on the Earth. It's not supposed to be here, so how did it get here? Dun, 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 dun. Well, not an asteroid, but they say comets. In fact, tens of millions of comets, they say, brought the water over a billion years. But now that we've gone to comets and we've returned matter from comets to the Earth, which is astounding.
Yes.
To accomplish that. And that's all operational science. That's not origin science. Mm-hmm. Operational is testable, repeatable, and so on. Comets, they find out, have a high level of deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen. It's a hydrogen atom with an extra neutron. And so it's a different isotope of hydrogen, basically. So they say, wow, we don't have that on Earth. So the kind of water that's up in comets is not the kind that filled up the oceans. So there's something wrong. So, Fred, everything they say should be made here, there, or wherever. They're finding it in the wrong places in massive quantities.
Okay. So where do you say comets came from then?
Good question. We go to Walt Brown for that, and it's hydroplate theory. Because when the crust of the Earth cracked, the Bible says during the global flood that the fountains of the great deep broke forth, then below the surface of the Earth there was water. Subterranean chamber, maybe 10 miles down and about a mile thick. And that water shot up through the broken crust of the earth with such force that much of it hit escape velocity and went into outer space. That's how the near side of the moon got so severely damaged. The near side more so than the far
side. Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense.
And that's where the comets came from the subterranean water 10 miles below the crust of the earth.
So once again, the evolutionists are 180 degrees off.
180. It's a lot of fun. And you know, the creationists even have a hard time with the moon beat up like it is. All the creationists who don't understand Walt Brown's theory, because they have to go to these ad hoc explanations of why Mercury has so many craters. Why does Mars have so many craters?
Yeah, the moon. Yeah.
Right. And with Earth losing a percent of its mass, now it's a tiny percent, but all the water in these comets is easily explained from the global flood on Earth, all of that water.
Okay. So how does that explain the deuterium?
The water being ejected from the subterranean chambers and what was going on with a lot of free neutrons in the subterranean chambers during the flood. We did that show on the origin of Earth's radioactivity, and there's just astounding evidence that we not only can explain why the entire Earth has a seam going around it, like a seam around the baseball, which is in the middle of the oceans. It's called the mid-oceanic ridge. It's because that's where the crust cracked, but also what was going on under the Earth and why there's so much radioactivity now in the crustal rocks of the Earth. Those issues are all tied together.
So, Bob, how did deuterium get into the comets?
You would ask that, wouldn't you, Fred? Actually, you and I did the show on the origin of Earth's radioactivity based on Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. What a brilliant job he does explaining the subterranean chamber below the crust of the Earth that cracked open, and it's a 46,000-mile crack that wraps around the Earth like a seam on a baseball, the mid-oceanic ridge. That's where the crust broke. Water from underneath shot up onto the Earth, and much of it escaped into space. And that water, and Walt explains it, we touched on the reasons why that water was rich in deuterium. So half of the water on the Earth's oceans comes from the water under the crust initially. And so it's diluted by half.
Okay.
And so we understand the origin and why that deuterium is in the comets.
Yeah, and I think our producer said that deuterium, the evolutionists think it came from the Big Bang.
Right.
So they're 180 degrees off again.
They are, and they also think that uranium and thorium came from the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. I talked to Lawrence Krauss about this. And Fred, it turns out that the uranium and thorium in the Earth, it's not spread out through the crust of the Earth, through the mantle of the Earth. It's concentrated in 1/3 of 1% of the Earth's mass, that is the continental crust. And if it came from stars, that supernova that blew up, it blowed up, you'd think it'd be, you know, spread out rather evenly, like under the oceans, for example. But no, it's near granite, and Walt Brown explains exactly why. It's virtually a prediction of his model that it's near granite, because we know what formed the radioactive elements.
So comets are kind of a reminder of the global flood, kind of like a rainbow is.
They really are. What a great point. And so, Fred, we're about out of time, but Mercury is not evidence for a billion-year-old solar system.
Yeah, and again, we could go through each planet, and they all have appearance of youth, not age.
Yeah, we said it already, but Spike Pisaris, we've interviewed him. His DVDs, it's a two-DVD set. You can get them individually. If you want, first try his Volume 1, Our Created Solar System.
He goes through planet one by one.
Yes. And the moon.
Oh, that reminds me of the sun, too. The sun's tilt. That's another one that's cool.
The sun is spinning, but not in a plane with the planets. Now, if everything condensed from a spinning gas cloud, then it all should be moving, rotating, and orbiting in the same direction and in the same plane. Well, the plane of the planets, when you look at the sun's spin on its axis, the sun is tilted 7 degrees.
7 degrees off that plane.
And that is a huge amount of tilt when you're talking about something as big as the sun.
So you'd have to have a huge Mike the Meteor to
knock the sun off. There's nothing.
I wonder how they explain that one.
They say, look, either something had to tilt the sun. Go ahead and figure that out. They don't know what tilted the sun. Or something tilted all the planets. Go ahead and figure that out. So it's just, wow. They're both ludicrous, the concepts. And just like with the spin of the solar system, 99% of it should be in the sun because it has 99% of the mass, but the sun is hardly turning on its axis very slowly. 99% of the angular momentum of the solar system is in the planets.
Yeah, it violates a major law of physics, the law of angular momentum.
That's right. So there is evidence after evidence, and these are huge observations. These aren't tiny little mysteries. These are huge. I mean, the biggest observations of astronomy in our solar system, and the planets shouldn't be where they are, and there they are.
Yep. So they make sense to us, but it's to the evolutionists, it's jaw-dropping because they did not expect it.
It's shocking. It's horrifying.
Horrifying.
So, Fred, we have the Spike Passaris DVDs, Volume 1, Our Created Solar System. Now, if you get it from us at Real Science Friday, just go to realsciencefriday.com, click on the store, the science department, and look at the videos. You'll just love that. But if you buy Volume 1, you'll be mad at yourself that you didn't also buy Volume 2.
Yeah, they're excellent.
On the stars and the galaxies. Just so tremendous and so affirming of God as our creator. Spike Passaris could not have done a better job. And he's working on Volume 3. I can't wait.
Oh, Volume 3, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we have also released a new resource ourselves. Fred, you and I and our friend Kevin Lee and Dr. Walt Brown, we have a brand new Real Science Friday resource called The Hydroplate Theory and Dr. Walt Brown. And we've got this on audio CD, so you can listen in your car, or on an MP3 CD. There's 11 shows on the Hydroplate Theory.
Oh, man, that's going to be awesome, Bob.
Yeah, Fred, it's so much fun. So thank you for joining me doing another episode.
Thanks, Bob.
What a great show. And check out our website, realsciencefriday.com. May God bless you.